Good morning to you, welcome. Thanks for taking the effort to be here. Obviously, as a portfolio committee, we at all times trying to learn, we're trying to improve on things and make sure that we have laws that are effective and efficient. Now, obviously, one of the more difficult or controversial, whatever things you want to call it, the kind of regimes in the environment is the EIA regime, the environmental impact assessments. Now, you're going to hear in the next few days, every business that comes here is going to tell us how the EIA stifles business, stifles development, and so on and so on. Now, then you're going to get others that are going to come here, the Ms. Puris and so on, who are going to tell us that it's not enough, and et cetera, et cetera. Now, all those things may be true, they may not be true. The reality of it is, we need, and our constitution is clear on this, and the policies of this government is clear, and I think even the opposition parties, that we all believe in a growth path which depends on sustainable development. And sustainable development would mean that you have to weigh up different interests and try to find a balance where the right balance lies between free and laissez-faire economic development and, of course, the protection of the environment. And I think we've had laws in our country, especially in a developing economic economy, which I suppose sometimes we'll have to find the difficulty to find the right balance between those. Now, we've gone through a process which I don't know how many people know about it, but we've recently passed a piece of legislation. We call it NEMLA 2. It's in the NCOP at the moment. Some of you may have made submissions to it. Where we've actually substantially changed our EIA regime. Now, I hope, obviously, many of these submissions were probably made before or during the processing of this bill, but I do hope that when people make submissions in the next 2 days that they'll bear in mind that there are these amendments and at least have a look at them and see to what extent that deal with some of the problems. You'll probably find there that I think we've created quite a few innovative mechanisms in that legislation which hopefully could help further find this right balance. Now, the hearing was intended, because there were so many submissions, to be over 3 days, but as some people withdrew, etc., I decided to compact them into 2 days, today and tomorrow, which means that we may have to sit a little bit into lunchtime and at the end of the day, but at least it means that we don't have to sit on Thursday. I'm sure members would be appreciative and the department will be appreciative about it because of the time constraints. Now, Mr. Skuzana and Mr. Ferguson have apologized. They'll be late. Mr. Bada is going to leave early. And then DG has to address the NCOP committee this morning, so she won't be with us. Now, our intention is that the department here, under guidance of COO Ms. McCourt and senior staff members of hers are here for the hearings, and also that the intention is, of course, for them from the issues that people raise to draft a report for us, and of course in those reports where issues are raised to give us also some possible responses and solutions, etc., so that we get a report that is already forward-looking in terms of what further improvements can be made to the system. So that will be our intention in the next while. Now, for the members, can I also say that, of course, you know that next week our workshop around rhinos can't take place. So there's no program for next week. So when we adjourn on Wednesday, we'll be adjourning for 2 weeks. OK? until the plenaries commence, I think in the middle of August somewhere. The rest of the program has not yet been approved and so on, so I can't say anything more than I've said already. But just to say now that you can make your arrangements accordingly, that when we finish on Wednesday, we'll be finished for a week and a half. Right, and you will be given copies of the current program, even if it's not approved, at least you can start having a look at it. All that you have to add to it is that we've been invited to a WRC symposium on the 25th to the 27th of September. That is also the week that we think of having that Rhino workshop, but we're waiting for approval, so we may have to adapt the program a bit, but just so that I'll send it to you, the symposium with the WRC, I think. There is a particular item where they want to engage us, I think, on the 25th as a portfolio committee, and I think we should be doing it. But I'll do all the necessary. Okay, those are all the issues. Any comments from any of the members at this stage? All right. Now, we're going to start the hearings. Please, for those that don't know, the way we usually do it is you have 10 minutes to state your case. So I do suggest that 10 minutes goes quick, that you make your most important points, and if there's time left, then you can start waffling on about other things, about the weather, and about how glad you are that my mother ever gave birth to me, and so on. But it's better to leave all those side comments. Just try and hone in on the main points so that we can actually pull from your input those. Obviously, we try and read as many of those submissions beforehand, but we've only really received the file a day or two ago, so we'll see how we go along. And then we'll use a few minutes to ask questions or comment. The real idea of it is, though, this time, is there's no right and wrong. It's for you to tell us where you think the weaknesses are, the challenges are, and for us to see with the department to have a discussion to see if there's any way that we can improve that. So as I said, there's no real right and wrong here. It's a question of trying to get the right balances and try to see what are the best practices elsewhere, particularly countries with equal levels of development than ours. All right, Ms. Madubela, who's the first? All right. I've asked the department to give us a beginning input to set the scene for us, what they have found, where the difficulties and challenges are. Also, not of course just generally for everyone, but also for themselves, where they find they have challenges and difficulties. So, Ms. McCourt, how are we going to go about this? Welcome to your team.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honourable members, and good morning, honourable stakeholders. We've requested that the DDG that is responsible for integrated environmental management systems, Mr. Wolf, do the presentation. The function is shared between two branches, the legal branch and the integrated environmental management or environmental advisory systems branch. So Mr. Wolf will be doing the presentation. He is supported by Chief Director, Ms. Fisher, and her directors that are directly involved in the work related to this chair. To keep it short, I'll hand over to Mr. Wolf.
Mr. Wolf, so welcome to you and your team.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members and Stakeholders. I think just to begin with some background, the environmental impact assessment system became a statutory requirement in September 97 through the Environmental Conservation Act, and two sets of regulations were set up. The first set requiring that environmental assessments be conducted, and the second set of regulations codifying the conduct and the content of these environmental assessments. After 1994, with the advent of the new democratic order, the national government went on a process after an intensive consultation process with stakeholders to formulate a new environmental environmental management being the legislative framework with the National Environmental Management Act of 1998. And in that act, the provisions for environmental impact assessment were contained in Chapter 5 of that act, and the Environmental Conservation Act of 1989 was repealed. In 2006, we initiated a study to assess the effectiveness and efficiency of the environmental impact assessment instrument or tool. And the findings of this assessment, effectiveness assessment, was presented at a conference held in Somerset West in November 2008 entitled 10 Years of Environmental Impact Assessment. In essence, the report concluded that the effectiveness of the environmental impact assessment tool was marginal and made several recommendations for its improvement. The issues, I'm just going through the issues that were raised in the 2008 report. Firstly, it was evident that there is no one-size-fits-all approach to environmental impact management. For an example, a housing development is completely different and with different requirements from a nuclear power station development. The second issue was that the environmental impact assessment does not address the broader set of social issues. Not all aspects are considered. For an example, an assessment of a nuclear plant does not assess the input to that nuclear plant or the impact of the input, the mining of uranium. Impact assessments were criticized for being more about procedure and administration and not so much about sustainability. There was contention that the process itself was flawed, as the environmental assessment practitioners are paid by the applicant, and this raises questions around independence and impartiality. In this context, there was contention that the practitioners should be appointed and paid by government from a fund to which the applicants actually contribute in order to get that impartiality. Site-specific assessments, or the EIA tool, is a site-specific assessment and does not address cumulative impacts of many developments. And this raises the need to use a range of other tools, including standards, environmental management frameworks, strategic environmental assessments, risk assessments, and so on. The issue of time delays in decision-making and the additional cost imposed by the environmental impact assessment process was raised. The capacity to review the assessed documents in various competent authorities at the provincial and national level. Many small activities are assessed in terms of the listed activities as opposed to an assessment of the whole development from a strategic perspective. There was a contention that the public participation process is not meaningful on one hand and excessive on the other hand, where the interested and affected parties appear to have all the power. The issue of affordability was raised, and this raises the need to support applicants without the means to comply with the legal requirements to do an EIA. There were issues related to how to address urgent requirements. For an example, industry could be limited due to the need for additional storage capacity, for the growth of industry could be limited due to the need for additional storage capacity, which requires EIA processes. There was a criticism that the EIA process does not consider positive aspects. For an example, example where a particular activity reduces climate change or greenhouse gas emissions. The list of activities includes maintenance aspects, and where maintenance is assessed as a greenfield project rather than an operational aspect. For an example, road maintenance, and this raised the issue of major cost for no reward. The issue of trivial reasons for appeals against records of decision. The listed activities do not consider projects within the ocean or within the sea area. A further issue was raised related to the range of instruments around the need to delist based on approved environmental management frameworks and the ability to do so. An issue was raised around regulatory alignment and cooperation between departments. The next issue was the environmental assessment practitioners' lack of technical expertise in the industry, and industry points out that it would be more efficient to use their own staff with a peer review mechanism. A further issue was raised around the requirement to look at alternatives, where alternatives may not be realistic, or the alternatives proposed may not be realistic, or whether the alternatives are not suitable in terms of what the applicant's objectives might be. The process just considers mitigation, and an issue was raised that very seldom is the no development choice being picked up as an option. Then there was a question about keeping up with the times, getting the adverts into the digital space, the issue related to the review of applications not being consistently done according to standards. The next issue related to the relevance of the conditions attached to the record of decision, which may in fact contradict other pillars, or alternatively go beyond the mandate of the environmental impact assessment. A further issue was raised in related to the interpretation of the listed activities not being consistently applied across provinces. The next issue relates to the reviewing department not being fully engaged at an early stage of the development, which results in the late request for additional information. An issue related to the follow-up on the conditions attached to the record of decisions, the lack of compliance monitoring, and an issue being raised around the abuse of Section 24G, where developers proceed with their development without authorization, and as it's cheaper to pay the fine. There's a need for a system to track the authorization process and enable applicants and the public to know who is dealing with it. There was a need to be able to collect the information made available in specialist reports and to create new data sets from that information. A need to reduce the time frames for state departments to comment on applications, and if no comment being received on time, proceed with the application processing. The issue of the need for good geographical information system data, and the ability for applicants to access that data online. And finally, the issue raised around the need for an integrated permitting a set of requirements related to ensure sustainable development, where the system should place a stronger emphasis on the direct and cumulative impacts on the environment, placed within a strategic context through strategic instruments such as environmental management frameworks, strategic environmental assessments and policy approaches. A second set of recommendations around the strategic approach was unpacked, where it was recommended that there is a need to categorize activities in terms of their strategic importance. For an example, a focus on infrastructure needs for the country, and the ability to do this through the identification of geographical areas in terms of the National Environmental Management Act, Section 24. Specific approaches, there was a recommendation related to specific approaches being adopted for specific circumstances. For an example, to tailor-make a basic assessment pro forma report where that such activity does not require unnecessary information or assessment processes. A third set of recommendations related to the package of instruments, where the range of instruments could improve the effectiveness and efficiency in terms of the fact that such assessments would be done in a strategic context. And this demands the use of a wide range of instruments in the regulatory system, for an example, strategic environmental assessments, to create this required strategic context. Then there was a recommendation related to the screening mechanism in order to provide an early check of the sites for sensitive elements as a pre-screening by specialists before a full-scale assessment is done. A set of recommendations around adoption of a holistic approach, given that environment is or environmental legislative competence is a concurrent competence between national, provincial, and local spheres of government, and this demands the development of a holistic environmental impact management approach. A set of recommendations related to enhancing the role of strategic environmental assessments in the development of the spatial development frameworks at local government level, where these strategic environmental assessments underpin the spatial development frameworks and result in avoidance of unnecessary impacts. Then a set of recommendations around compliance monitoring and enforcement, the delegation of decision making to more junior levels within the competent authority staff structures where strategic instruments have been adopted, and finally the issues around human resource development in order to enhance career development pathways. So at the end of this 2008 conference in Somerset West, the essential conference resolution was that all these recommendations and issues would be considered in a stakeholder process through a formal process to recommend a strategy for integrated environmental management to government for consideration. Just to point out, Chair, at this point, the tension that we face, which I think you alluded to. On the one hand, we have the NGO community to a large extent, and some civil society organizations demanding absolute control of development in terms of minimizing environment. on the other hand, we have industry advocating for soft regulatory approaches. So this is the range of views that this stakeholder-driven process to develop an integrated environmental strategy for to be recommended to government sits. So in essence, where we sit is with a set of activities that are being undertaken to deal with the concerns that have been raised. So the point is that while we develop this in, strategy, stakeholder-driven process, the agreement was that government would continue to act on the recommendations from the report where possible. And I think you've alluded to it in the NEMA NEMA laws, I mean, laws amendments or bill, which is before the NCRP at the moment. So a number of maybe just touch on the EIA management strategy approach briefly. I think the point to make here is that the process is stakeholder-driven. Those stakeholders include the competent authorities as well as industry, as well as labour, as well as the NGO sector. It also, in the broader context, has provided an opportunity to begin to address issues which were not raised in the efficiency and effectiveness report. But on the other hand, at this point in time, it's been a three-year process. We do expect the findings to be produced in March 2014. The purpose of this EIA management strategy process is that it intends to identify the desired future state of the integrated environment management system for South Africa and make recommendations around what needs to be done to achieve it. Elements of this desired state include an integrated environmental management system supported by environment-informed special instrument sector strategies and policies with a view to optimizing the regulatory system through the adoption and introduction of a wide range of different assessment tools tailor-made for different kinds of circumstances. And this would result in an integrated or an integration of the various government processes, such as the IDP, the Spatial Development Framework, Environmental Management Framework, Strategic Environmental Assessment, Planning Schemes, or Zoning Plans. And finally, all of this to end up with a fully capacitated sector. So the proposed main elements of the strategy as it is emerging at the moment, Chair, is that all the integrated environmental management processes need to be guided by a vision of sustainability. Effective integration, that it needs to produce an effective integration of between the spheres of government and across government departments. And this could include an integrated permitting and authorization approach, strategic development plans and frameworks that are aligned in the context of timing and scale, as well as the development of mandates to local authorities to implement national standards. In order to do this, technical tools to effectively contribute to these sustainability principles include establishing a hierarchy of environmental plans, establishing a suite of tools for all management phases so that we can increase our focus on implementation and the monitoring and evaluation phases of the work. The ability to choose the most appropriate tool for the application. The use of spatial tools to identify activities which could be excluded from the formal environmental authorization process. The provision of up-to-date and readily available environmental information. The setting sustainability targets and the monitoring and evaluation and reporting thereon, as well as the establishment of a quality assurance system through a peer review process. It is proposed in the strategy that an adaptive management approach be taken, which is informed by a monitoring and evaluation process. It is recommended that a professional and transformed environmental sector be established, where environmental information and management systems are kept up to date and made available and accessible to all role players. And in this respect, all role players are capacitated and in terms of environmental awareness as well as the suite of environmental management instruments, and that where there is an understanding of the role of public participation process. So the question now is, what interim actions have we been taken? So this environmental impact management strategy is underway. Its results or findings will be made available in March 2014. But as agreed, we didn't sit around for 3 years doing nothing, waiting for the strategy. So we have taken a set of interim actions, and I think the COO talked to the first action, which involved separating the environmental impact assessment policy and review process from the regulators. in terms of structurally separating them. The second was the development of the tracking and public access systems so that we could track the progress of EIAs and in this way improve the statistics available of assessments undertaken within time frames and out.
You can do that nationally and provincially.
Correct, yeah. Through a common e-platform. I'll talk to that a little bit here. The third revolved around the capacitation of provinces through the implementation of occupational class or occupational, what's OSD stand for? But basically it's about focusing on the skills and value for money payment of environmental practitioners within the government's service. But it also revolved around improving access at provincial level to hardware and software, ensuring that sufficient administration staff is provided, and so on. The next area of action we focused on was the geographic information systems and developing an intranet and internet capacity in order to make the environmental spatial data available to both the applicants and the case officers. Then a further screening tool was developed to do pre-screening of issues in order to assist the case officers. We have been working on a set of standards at the moment looking at dangerous goods and providing support to provincial set of provincial standards around ostrich farming. time frame for the submission of documents by the applicants. One of the challenges we experience here is that while there are time frames prescribed for competent authorities, there's no time frames prescribed for applicants to submit the information. The next issue was around the integration of the waste and the environmental impact assessment authorizations and a set of work around drafting regulations to adopt spatial tools, as well as actually conducting strategic environmental assessments to support the strategic or the SIPS projects, the strategic integrated projects. In addition, Chair, we have taken a set of actions around our capacity and support services. We have been working with industry or the practitioners to set up EHASA, or the Environmental Protection and Practitioner Association of South Africa, which is in essence a voluntary organisation, and the Minister is currently considering the application for recognition. But in addition to that, we have also established a pro bono, or through an engagement with the Northwest University, a system to provide pro bono services to, at this point in time, municipalities, but with a view to extend them to applicants without the means to pay for environmental assessment support services. If I could just touch on the restructuring of the environmental impact management function. In essence, we have split at a national level the function into the integrated environmental management policy and systems building function, and separated it from the assessment and monitoring and enforcement function. So you don't have a mix of promotion and enforcement where one, the same officer can be helping an applicant one day and arresting them the next. So it's just a standard good governance segregation of duties issue. And in this way, we've really focused or put dedicated focus on the recommendations which have emerged from the efficiency and effectiveness report, and really began building the systems and tools which are needed to make the system much more effective and efficient, while at the same time improving the actual assessment process and linking it with the compliance and enforcement process. Next slide. In terms of the performance statistics and access to the statistics, basically what we've developed is an electronic system which is called the NEAS, or the National Environmental Assessment System, and are working towards a public portal in this regard. We have developed a system, and we are currently in the process of working with the provinces in order to reconcile the manual and the electronic reporting systems. I'm not going to go through the details of these numbers, Chair, but just to point out that if you look at the numbers, we have 47 applications pending out of time frames, which are ascribed to delays due to the authorities, but we have a vastly larger number of applications pending, awaiting information from the applicants themselves. Next slide. This is the work that we're doing to reconcile the manual system that provinces have versus the electronic system. As you can see, the information in the NIS, the pink information, is fully comprehensive. But the problem that we experience is that there's some degree of disjunction between the manual records kept by the provinces and what is recorded on the NIS. We are getting very close and working with these authorities to ensure that the uptake of this new electronic portal that is standardized across the country is working fully on the stream. A further issue I just wanted to point to, Chair, is that if you look at the number of applications received per quarter, in essence, since April 2012, we're really looking like per reviewer in the government departments about 30 assessments per annum. Because one of the issues that was raised related to workload and capacity, and actual statistics reflect that the number of reviewers are, in fact, sufficient. If you look at the statistics at the National Department of Environment, pending outside of the time frames, you can see since the introduction of these measures in the second quarter of 2012, there's been a steady improvement in reduction in the number of in the number of applications which are out of time frame. And looking at the issue of integrating across the government departments, the key issues are waste, water use, licensing, and mining rights. We have, as you're aware, Chair, worked with the Department of Minerals and Energy, as well as the Department of Water Affairs, in order to align the regulatory processes and revised timeframes. If you look at the next slide, this is the process in essence that we have agreed in terms of aligning the applications for a mining right. In order and through this process have managed to reduce the number of days. I'm not going to go through the details. I'm sure this process will be publicly available. Next slide. And similarly, what this agreement has done is resulted in a set of amendments to regulations in order to reach a decision within a much reduced time frame. Next slide. In terms of work on the geographic information system data support and supporting information for facial applications, we have developed a standardized GIS data set as a basis for screening of applications. At the moment, this is on our internal department intranet, but we are working to make it available on the internet within the next 2 months. So this information will be freely available to both applicants as well as other competent authorities. And in this respect, we hope that to support a much shortened process of determining the sensitivity of a site by its location. In essence, this is a picture of the system, which includes the GIS screening tool. So we're developing a screening tool which will enable case officers as well as applicants to more efficiently and effectively do this. Next slide. This is just a picture of what the spatial information looks like on the internet at the moment, which will be available on the internet. Next slide. recommendations that the EIA or the Environmental Impact Assessment needs to be undertaken within the context of a strategic framework in order to make it more effective. We have used the SIF process, the 18 SIFs process, in order to, as a case study, to test these range of new approaches and new systems and new tools within this strategic context. As a background, we have a national goal to set of creating 5 million new jobs by 2020. The issue of poor coordination, weak integration as barriers to development and development have been identified as structural problems in the economy. And the SIP process identifies opportunities in specific sectors and markets through an infrastructure approach to drive job creation. So, in essence, the SIP process is based on a need analysis, gap analysis, at a strategic level, and indicates possible bulk infrastructure requirements in order to unlock economic development, sustainable economic development corridors across the country. Next slide. Just as an example, this is a picture of SIP 1, which is in the northern mineral belt, and is really a regional clustering of projects linked with major corridor projects, including road development, electricity generation, electricity transmission distribution, as well as coal to liquid facilities, water infrastructure, rail infrastructure, and mining infrastructure. From the Waterberg, linked by the water corridor, and it includes the shift from road to rail. So this is an example of a SIP, and the key characteristic of these SIPs is scale. So instead of just a little couple of solar panels, this is the kind of scale of a solar PV facility. This one taken from Brandenburg in Germany, but just an example. Next slide. So the question is how we respond to these strategic integrated projects at a national level. In essence, the grouping of all the SIPs could be classified from an environmental impact assessment perspective into corridor developments, such as pipelines, transmission lines, large development nodes, development projects such as the ports and IDZs, or a set of recurring components which are repeated in various nodal projects, in particular around transport nodes. Then we've got a set of projects within the system related to coal-based projects, which have climate and air emission impacts. A set of SIPs related to mining and the establishment of new mines. And then there are some SIPs which are comprised of projects which don't require authorization. So what we are proposing is a new approach to these SIPs in order to test out much more effective and efficient methodology for environmental impact assessment. Just looking at an example of SIP 8, which is adopting a strategic environmental assessment approach, where we identify geographical areas most suitable for the rollout of renewable energy projects. So this involves a positive and negative mapping approach, in essence, identify where the solar radiation and wind resources lie, and then you map, overlay land identified the wounded solar corridors, you've identified areas of low potential, you've overlaid areas of environmental sensitivity, which enables you to, in essence, create zones where we could have different environmental impact assessment requirements in zones of low environmental sensitivity but high potential for the resource. On the way forward, Jay, we want to use the SIP process as a case study to inform the process of streamlining and integrating authorizations, both within spheres of government as well as between spheres of government. We need these learnings to feed into the EIA management strategy process and ultimately undertake the law reform process, which is your job, Chair and honourable members, reform and streamline the system. And in this way, we hope to be able to address all the issues raised related to the efficiency and effectiveness of the current EIA process through legislative amendment process and the development of new tools. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I just want to make a small addition in terms of, in the interest of time, we didn't go on things that we have done completely finalised already. If we go through the original list of issues that had to be addressed in the 2008 report, we had two sets of law reform processes before the NEMA 2 that you just spoke to. The one was the 2008 amendments to NEMA, where we have enabled, for example, the exclusion of activities based on EMFs, etc., and that was in the 2008 amendment. And we have also had the 2010 amendments to the EIA regulations, where we have, in fact, delisted many of these small, insignificant activities, and where we have identified sensitive areas where additional activities have been listed. So I think there has been those developments. There has also, we have so far finalized 50 environmental management frameworks in the country, just over 50, which have been finalized. And further, if you include the ones that are under development, it takes the total of the environmental management framework to 140. And that set the context of evaluating again cumulative impacts, etc. We have, however, not yet delisted any activity as envisaged based on these environmental management frameworks. So if we go to that original findings or concerns that were raised, there has been things that have been dealt with and addressed, and then there is a set of continuation in terms of continuously implementing while we are finalising the strategy. Thanks, Chair.
I thought it was an excellent input. I really think very thoughtful, very worked through, and obviously very complicated. I mean, it's not an easy issue. I mean, it's very clear that when we introduced these EIAs, it was a novelty in the beginning of our democracy, and that we've gone through many processes of seeing how to do it better, and they'll accumulate next year in hopefully final report we go then. Obviously, there are a lot of things that have happened in the meantime. Process hasn't stood still, these legislative changes and all the others. But I think one of the interesting things that has taken and where gears have been shifted, and I think none of us are really prepared for it. If I look at the kind of public commentary on it, I can see that we're at sea and we're not understanding the constitutional and legal issues, and definitely not the practical issues. And that is around the creation of the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Committee. I mean, there they've now identified 19 sectors for this infrastructure development. And if you look at the different departments, I think that the departments are not geared to the extent that they should to deal with these in a coordinated infrastructure project, as you explained here. I think this legislation we've just passed goes some way to helping and creating a framework there. But I think the thinking is still, if I look at some of the other departments, I think the thinking is very muddled. And they've not thought through the constitutional and legal consequences of it. So although I think it's an excellent initiative and a good way we're going, we must be careful of thinking through it carefully. Many of our laws now we're finding when we are engaged with you, and we saw this last week when you came with all these amendments to the legislation, the thinking that we had in 94 and 97 was a very fragmented and wrong thinking in terms of the real potential, in terms of where the real legal and competencies and powers lie. I mean, you look at the whole area of air quality control, and that is just a recipe for disaster what we've done there, and the way that we've interpreted things. So these are opportunities now given to us to start creating a more streamlined and a more appetite. So we've been in government now for 20 years, and I mean that all of us, because even those that were in government previously, they weren't really in government, they were... Well, it's easier, let me just say, it's easier to be a dictator than to be a democrat. It's much easier. Much easier to write orders and things and beat people up and so on, and debate with them when you don't like what they say. So obviously those complexities are there, but I think after 20 years we need to sort it out. So I think there's a lot of good stuff. I mean, I really am very, very excited by what you've told us here, where we're going. There's a lot of potential. The only problem is the time frame. We need to slow. We have to go quicker. If we can't learn in 20 years, we're never going to learn. And I don't mean that we must go just jump into things, but I really think we've got enough experience around now to move these processes quicker. This was just really background, but are there any comments or questions from the members before we continue the oral submissions? Anything? Okay. All right. Thanks, department. Let's start. I think the first submission I see here is from Professor Hill from the University of Cape Town. It's submission number one. Wait, Professor Hill. There you are, sir. Do you need the... Is he here? Just let him smooth. Oh, I think all of you guys will move up a few seats so that the presenters can come and sit down here.
From the IPASA Constitution. I'm a member of the board of IPASA. And I like this because it focuses, as you can see, on alternatives, looking at a range of projects to find the best one. It talks about mitigation of adverse impacts and enhancement of benefits. And perhaps most importantly in the South African context, it talks about equitable distribution of impacts and benefits. This is really important in a country where about half of our population live below the poverty line, and the Gini coefficient is, I understand it, hovering around 0.7. Next slide. This slide shows the stages of the environmental assessment process, and I'm not going to talk to them, focus on the first point here. In terms of screening, and I assume that there's a lot of people who know all the details here, people on my left and others, but an introduction to the notion of screening. You imagine a butterfly net where you catch certain projects in that net and smaller ones slip through. And we need to do that more effectively in South Africa. The established that the person who formulated the notion of an environmental was a professor in the United States, Professor Linton Bolvor. And I've taken two words from his work, which I think are really important. He says that environmental assessment must start out in a cautionary mode and then change into corrective mode when we find these significant issues. And I think some of the problems that DEA have been dealing with over the years is to streamline the process, to make sure that more things slip through that butterfly net using other tools like strategic environmental assessment. The assessment process, in more knowledge-based, scientific input, specialist input, and local knowledge. This discipline also involves the bringing together of this information with value judgments of how we as a society want to see our nation grow and how we want to create the future environment. Next slide. This was my very first EIA on graduation as a master's student. It was for a city engineer in Port Elizabeth, and it was a new bridge across the Swartkops River. Let me just turn on my pointer here. And the reason for showing this slide, and it's going to help us, is that the city engineer wanted to put a bridge across that canal there, and then a bridge across the estuary here, where it's quite a lot wider. As a result of input from the University of Port Elizabeth Zoology Department, they said that this water here comes out of a power station, and you can see it's hot, and that this isn't a natural system worth protecting. So fill that in, save 50 metres of bridge there, save 50 metres of bridge across the river, and then keep off the conservation of the salt marsh vegetation on the other side. So here's an EIA that saved 100 metres of road bridge, many millions of rands, and this is what I argue that environmental assessment can do, can make better and more cost-effective projects. In corrective mode, next slide, we look at alternatives. Two routes through the Mahali Dam, the Lesotho Highlands project. My students were involved in this project. Next slide. And along one of the routes there was endangered fish, the Maluti Mer. Next slide. So what I asked the students to do was on one day to capture all the information that was relevant and necessary for the decision to be taken between these two routes. And again, as a proponent of environmental assessment, to say here that the alternative two, which is mostly shade, has been the preferred option, was the cheapest option and didn't impact on that rare fish. So there can be win-win situations if we do our planning properly. Next slide. Now, this slide on the phases of the evolution of environmental assessment in South Africa have been dealt with by the previous speaker, and it just captures the fact that for the first 20 years it was under a voluntary regime, and from 1997 to the present we've had compulsory practice. Next slide. In 2006, the regulations were changed to speed up the process, and it was true that we were doing too many EIAs, and although DEA have done a lot to reduce the number of different activities, we're probably still doing too many. Next slide. The 2006 regulations introduced the basic assessment process for smaller activities, which are easily managed, which is a quicker approach. But one still has to consider alternatives in basic assessment. And perhaps we need a more nuanced screening approach in future with more than just these two approaches of the basic and full assessment. Next slide. We've heard quite a lot about the time frames and how DEA have become more effective in processing applications within the time frame stipulated in the regulations. Next slide. The review, the REE study, the review of the efficiency and effectiveness study, showed that on average it took consultants across the range from the Department of Environmental Affairs on the left and then through all provinces on the bottom axis, in a total of 502 cases over that period from 1997 to 2008, an average of 5 months to produce the EIA. Now I know from colleagues who do EIAs all the time that big projects take longer than 5 months. Next slide. But that it took the authorities an average of 5.5 months to review those applications, with obvious outliers of processes taking a lot longer. But my argument all along is that if you integrate the environmental considerations into the planning and design process, then the planning for these big infrastructure developments, and we've heard about the president's infrastructural plans, these big projects take many, many years to get off the drawing board and onto the ground. And the EIA should not be a time constraint there. There's a lot of time in planning, and we need to make sure that our environmental information is introduced and integrated into that time process timely so that it doesn't hold up the process. We get the better project that I alluded to. I didn't know what DEA was going to present this morning, but I am an active member of the Project Steering Committee of the EIAMS project, the National Strategy Project, and I wanted here to encourage the Portfolio Committee to take the outcome of our process seriously in future. We're meeting on the 15th and 16th of August in Pretoria to agree on platforms and pillars that are going to underpin this new strategy for EIA in South Africa. Could you go back to the previous slide? The previous speaker did talk to the these 8
we have a minute left, isn't it?
Minute left. Okay, next slide. Next slide. So my main recommendation then is to incrementally improve the functioning of the existing systems of environmental assessment and management. For example, current provisions of the discretion by authorities are not yet widely exercised. And South Africa's environmental authorization requirements need to evolve into more strategically and proactively geared and streamlined approaches, which require that we do more strategic assessments, environmental management framework, and fewer project-level EIAs. This needs to be as early in the planning process as possible, and the Minister of Water and Environmental Affairs, Ms. Molewa, appoint the Environmental Assessment Practitioners Association of South Africa as a registration authority. Next slide. This shows the spectrum of environmental management tools. The two ones in blue there, the EIA of projects and the EMP of construction, are where we've been focusing a lot of our effort. We've got to go earlier to the strategic assessment, which is about plans on at a larger scale, and more towards the voluntary system, the currently voluntary systems of environmental management systems. Next slide. Here I'll draw to your attention what I see as an exemplar of more strategic and proactive approaches, which have been adopted by the City of Cape Town in the last few years. I noted that the City was not going to be presenting to this hearing, where they have incorporated environmental management frameworks into the development of spatial development plans. Next slide. So, for example, on this map of the peninsula, the orange area is the Cape Winelands, the Constantia Winelands, next slide, where, as is typical with EMFs, the whole idea is that in orange you can say which type of activities would be inappropriate in that area, industrial, mining. In yellow, agri-tourism might be more acceptable, still with some impacts, but you can manage that. And then in green, those kind of activities, agricultural and residential units, appropriate residential units, which would not require an environmental assessment. Next slide. This is my final slide. As the chair of the Standards and Criteria Committee of ECASA, I've been working with SACO, the South African Qualifications Authority. We have a qualification that is registered by SACO for environmental assessment practice. What we are currently doing is working with the Council on Higher Education to set in place procedures that will allow tertiary institutions like my own to have our programs accredited But where this is really groundbreaking is that environmental assessment is practiced by a range of professionals: landscape architects, town regional planners, civil engineers, environmental scientists. And so this is breaking new ground in the way in which the Council on Higher Education has to go about accrediting tertiary university level programs. Because we're going to have to accredit programs in city region planning, landscape architecture, civil engineering, and environmental assessment to make sure that the students coming out of those programs can register with the ASA once we are appointed as a registration authority, and then go into the process of being a candidate environmental assessment practitioner before registering some years later after having had practical experience. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Professor. I'm sorry we pressurized you for time. I gave you a minute or two more because of these IPAHA issues. I think they're important to have a regulating body quickly in place so that good practices can take place and the right people are doing it. So I hope that after moving with this thing, to get it correct and get it sorted out properly. All right. Some very useful things. I think the practical issues for me were quite informative. The practical examples, because it really shows you the kind of good things that can happen from EAAs, and should happen from EAAs. So I thought they were very useful. Members, comments, questions, everything clear? The IMASA exists at the moment, doesn't it?
IMASA was formed in April 2011. The board was nominated in November 2011. We first met in February 2011. We've met four times each year since then. We have another meeting tomorrow. But we have submitted an application to the minister to be appointed as the registration authority under Section 24H of NEMA and are awaiting her decision on that. The chair of our board, Sibu Sisiwehela, is here, and she's going to be giving a full presentation this afternoon on the further activities of the board.
Thank you. No questions, no comments? All understood? All right, now we'll definitely take all your issues under advisement. I'm sorry that this City of Cape Town, as you say, you think you're doing good stuff and they're not going to come, but we'll see what the problem is there at some stage. Okay, thank you very much, Professor. This is a good start, good first input. Now it is Ms. Suri. She's part of the furniture here, yeah. She's part of the family. She spends almost more time in the committee than at work. Welcome, ma'am. 10 minutes.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you, Mike, for the equity. Well, nice to see everybody. Thanks for the opportunity, Chair, for this discussion. I think it's particularly helpful for us also to get a proper presentation by the court and to get a sense of what's the latest and what's been happening. Obviously, Chair, you're keeping time quite carefully, so I'll try to be very to the point. And we'll try to contribute something different, I guess, from what you'll hear from other presentations in the next couple of days. So first of all, just a couple of comments about the legal context for EAA, which is still very important. And secondly, just a kind of single remark about the efficacy of EIA requirements, and then a couple of issues for improvement, strength and weakness and improvement. There we go. So legal context, I think, you know, this really struck us when this call came out for comments and for this hearing, is that we're still having discussions about EIA and why we have it, etc. And I think we want to make the point very loud and clear from our organisation and from any of our partners that that is not a strategy, not what we call strategy or nice to have, but in fact a constitutional imperative. I won't go into the details of the sections, but it's also not the fact of EIA, of, you know, NEMA principles and principles of integrated environmental management, but also the way in which we do EIA and the space it creates for public participation because of the right to just and legislative action. So it's not really a discussion, you know, that we want to have about whether we still need this, but rather how the state is realizing this constitutional obligation. And we'll talk a little bit later about adequate resourcing, which we believe is also a legal and constitutional issue. And ultimately what we want to see is meaningful EIA that contributes to the realization of the environmental rights and to sustainable development. I hope I'm speaking to one of those here. moving on to the efficacy of the EIA regime, I still wanted to make a sort of a single remark there, which is, so first of all, maybe just acknowledge that there's been significant development of this regime over time. I think the department has really gone out of its way to deal with a lot of criticism against the EIA. And our system has become much more sophisticated over time than when we started, unquestionably. However, we still see ongoing attempts at dilution and limitation of the EIA. Just a couple of months ago, we had to write a 20-page submission about the constraints that was being proposed under the draft infrastructure development law, for example. We've now seen for the first time, thank you for the flow charts on the integrated servicing, which we've never seen before. We see a 300-day limit. I know a lot of people think that's great, but people think it's too long. So for us, it's all of concern, those kind of constraints. And we worry about what impact that has on the quality of EIA, as Professor Hill was also alluding to earlier. Ultimately, and I think the chair mentioned it, you know, with referring to the case studies, I think it's something that's sorely missing is an empirical assessment and empirical data about the impacts of EIA and how it assisted us in our transition to a green economy. I think we struggle with that. Every time we have to defend the system, we struggle to find the evidence and the evidence base to do that. And it's not just about numbers. This is about actual quality, sort of quality issue, not a quantity issue, as I'll talk to in 1 second. Then just moving on briefly to recommendations, essentially, we put up this purpose of integrated environmental management to remind us that EIA is actually not a regulatory system so much, it is about life and death, and it is about health, and it's about quality of life and well-being, and it's about future generations. It really stands between us and what would happen if we just let everybody do what they wanted, wherever they wanted. And in that sense, I must say that it's not really absolute control that we want over the EIA process, the world is referring to, but rather compliance with the law. Self-regulation is what brought us acid mine drainage and climate change. So I think we can put that aside. And I think also to put aside a common misconception is that many NGOs also support streamlined processes. The EIA is a very burdensome process, particularly compared to the other licensing processes, very burdensome in civil society, and there are communities in this country that are facing multiple series of license applications, and it's extremely difficult for them to participate in those. So as long as the fear of the EIA can be maintained to achieve realization of Section 24, the use of tools and frameworks and SEAs and whatever else that is available to streamline the system would be supported, generally speaking, by us and for society organizations. All right, so I'm not going to have a lot of time for the recommendations, so I'll just refer to them. Each one is the issue of quality of quantity, quality versus quantity. We see a lot of your emphasis on numbers when we talk about EIA. You heard certainly the people from the department talking very expressly about numbers of applications, numbers of pools. If you look at the DEA strategic plan for 2012 to 2017, it's full of numbers, full numbers of applications process. And the reality of that is that doesn't tell us how effective the EIA has been, and it doesn't tell us how effectively it's assisted us to achieve sustainable development. We really think that we should in fact not be counting, rather than counting applications and counting data, should we not be measuring outcomes instead. I'm sure the committee will hear quite a lot more about that from other people in the next couple of days. There's a slide there about accessibility of EIA and databases. And maybe I could just deal with access to information issues here at the same time. There's a lot of emphasis when we talk about access to information and database on applicants and competent authorities. Interested and affected parties are not usually given us that benefit, and they really are on the back foot when it comes to these issues. Having said that, we also argue for compliance promotion, that there's a real space for that in making it easier, particularly for persistently offending sections of society, particularly here, we have given the example of farmers, who actually are custodians of very important biodiversity areas, and making it easier for them to comply with the law. All right, then just a comment about public participation. You won't be surprised to hear us talking about this. we struggle as a society organization, community organizations, with public participation. We generally regard it as being capable of making meaningful contributions. If the proposal is presented as a fait accompli, we're still struggling with the language, literary, the technical nature of documents when it comes to poorer communities. And very little appreciation of those issues by conference authorities, and very little support from conference authorities across the country. And generally, you know, we would argue that conference authorities can make a huge difference to the way and the tone in which Africans interact with communities affected by these proposals across the country. Alright, I think I've spoken about access to information. I just want to mention, I understand that the compliance monitoring is still at about 4%. Against authorization. That's roughly how many of the authorizations
are
And we argued before this committee that giving citizens access to permits, for example, and compliance data would really assist in broadening the scope of that compliance monitoring and give the public the proper space that's recognized in NEMA. And then finally, probably the most important point that I'd like to make is about appropriate public expenditure, which again will also be a constitutional issue as part of the state's obligation to realise Section 24. I think I heard Mr. Wilt say earlier that that's improved quite a lot. I'm delighted that's true. but generally, the statistics that we see is high staff turnover, vacancy rates. Now we're increasingly concerned about the DMR's capacity. Our proposal will also be implementing these EIA regulations. At the DMR, the last statistics we had is that they had 78 positions, quite junior positions, responsible for all aspects of the environment, not just licensing or compliance monitoring or enforcement, but all of it. 13 of those positions were vacant. We've just received a parliamentary question answer from the minister saying that there's a regulatory assessment underway, no statistics, no numbers. Know that in the last budget, the DMR allocated 59 million rand for both enhancing SAMRAD, the application system, and for implementing NEMA. And you can compare that. We do a bit of rough calculations. We don't have access to all the information, but compare that to around about, how much is that cut to? 60, 70 million, what is that? Spent by the department on those functions combined, spent by the DA on those things. So we are concerned about this, Chair, and we're going to talk to you about this again as we move towards the mining legislation.
You had a bill introduced yesterday or the week before or something.
Yes. So we are going to be talking about this again, and we're concerned about whether this is an appropriate way to spend public funds, rather than spending funding and enhancing the capacity of those officials and those departments who already sit with the expertise and who have already implemented NEMA and the EIA regulations for the last 20 years. Chair, just that you've heard us talk quite a lot about these other issues we might talk about it today. We still think that Section 24G, even with the amendments, we're really appreciative of the amendments that the committee has recommended, the department has proposed. We still argue that Section 24G undermines the regulatory regime, and we continue to argue that for the foreseeable future.
What is the mind law?
Section 24G, the rectification provision.
No, we just heard of now. You guys will now come get awake and make sure that those things are implemented. The partners gave them teeth.
Yeah.
They had no teeth before. They were like one of these old men without teeth, you know? They got no teeth. Now let's see first if they're going to use the teeth, right, with your help. If not, then we'll just have to give them some false teeth. I mean, it's the only way it can work. Give a chance. These guys are committed to this. And we're now giving them teeth, so let's see how it works.
As I said, we are appreciative of the amendments that we have addressed some of the most urgent issues around us. So, and then secondly, we have argued also before quite extensively for civil and administrative penalties that we believe would greatly improve enforcement, including of environmental authorizations. In conclusion, we contend that the South African state is legally compelled to give effect to Section 243 EIA regulations, and that it must put in place sufficient expertise mechanism and resources to maintain that effective and valid EIA regime. So the issue should be, is how do we get more effective, not, you know, do we still need this process, or how far can we, how can we limit it, and how can we make the time period as fast as possible?
From this committee's point of view, you have all our support on that.
Okay.
I can't talk for the rest of the world, but this committee will not easily go back on EIAs.
If there's one thing that we'd like to see, Chair, at this point, and I know you hear a lot of recommendations in the next couple of days, but we'd like to see appropriate resourcing and of appropriately incentivized EIA staff in the appropriate departments. Again, I alluded to the arguments that we put before you when we get to talk about mining EIAs.
You know what the problem is, of course? As soon as we train them and they're good, then you guys or some business takes them. That's what happens all the time. It's a problem government. The good ones are taken all the time, they just leave the bad ones. Which is no reflection on this one here. These are good ones that are committed. Thank you very much. There's a lot of good points there. We'll take it all into consideration. Any comments, any questions, any things you want to engage on? Obviously, I hope you are preparing for the legislation. The mining one, so that you can come and give your inputs. We have insisted in the inputs that that we have to see more than just the legislation. If the compromise is synchronized processes, which is the best compromise that could have been gotten in the process, if that is the case, then we need to be shown how it's going to be done. Because clearly those synchronized processes are not in the legislation. So if we were to pass the legislation, we would just be passing a blank check as it stands now. Because it just basically says this will now be done in this department or this, and there will be an appeal procedure. But the compromise is the synchronization. And if that's not proper, and if that doesn't trump, other processes in the mining, then we're going to have a problem with the debate. We've told the department this, and I hope you guys in your inputs highlight these. All right, no questions, no comments. Oh, sorry, Mr. Rogers.
Thanks. Just a question of clarity. In your final recommendation, you talk about appropriately incentivized staff. Are we saying underpaid, or are we... What is your proposal then?
Thank you. I'm sure that Bob can give you more specific information about this. From the information we can gather around, it does seem that, you know, that a lot could be gained by providing. It's a problem of in the process in general, I would say. We deal with job evaluation issues, so it's getting people to the right level who are appropriately incentivized to work money, but other things as well. And so I think that should take a lot of issues in society, in the public sector generally. But as I said, the information that we have shows that, you know, to get people to stay in jobs, to see themselves as career bureaucrats and maintain that expertise in the department, you do need to, for those people to be at the right job level. And I think that's also why we worry a lot about the problem of mineral resources, where we see in very junior positions responsible for environmental inputs. So that's going to be something that we're going to be talking about a lot.
The government's a funny thing. I've learned in the last 2 years. Where it's important, your front desk, for example, in Home Affairs, that'll be your most junior. It should be your senior people dealing with problems. So if they don't deal with the problem, then they pass the problem up, then files get lost, then they get another set of files, then it comes back with an instruction, get that certificate, and then it comes. The problem we have in everything we do in government, we really seem to get the whole structure of where your most important people should be. All based on an authoritarian system, that the decision is taken somewhere further down the line. And you don't equip and empower people to be decision makers,
people who don't employ your front desk. So, you know, this is the same thing. Your people that have to do the compliance and stuff, your most junior people in the department, as they get better, they get taken out of parts of the department or they get taken out of the department by industry. And it's just a continuous problem in government. I mean, everywhere. It doesn't matter which department you go to. Justice will be the same. Water will be the same. And that is why when Al spoke about the OSD system, the OSD system is one of the innovative ways. But you see, the OSDs, usually the resistance is in the department. Because that Department of Environment will not, the higher staff there will not be happy if they not OSD and some other group in the department made OSD, if you know what I mean. So I find, I mean, if you look where the resistance comes from, it will come from within the department. Because what you're doing is you are starting to give preference for one unit in the department being better paid than another. Of course, qualification goes with it. But that is what you do. So these are very complicated things. Very complicated things. The departments themselves can't see the word. Take the police force. What's the most important aspect of policing? People think the guys with the jackboots and the guns who storm buildings are your most important. Of course they're important. But your most important people for crime fighting are detectives. Detectives catch the crooks and put them away. If they don't investigate properly, that is why we don't get prosecution. Now try and suggest to the police that detectives have to be OSD. And the rest of them are not going to be OSD. So I think it's, you know, we need to look at innovative ways. It's a very, very complicated issue. This thing of getting the right capacity to the right places and holding it onto it. Also, you have to deal with the trade unions. As soon as you start saying to the trade union, this sector is going to get more salaries than those, absolutely stop it. So it's a very, very complex issue. And one that we're going to have to look at carefully as far as these things. Makes it even more complicated, of course, if another department does it, because we have no say over it, so that makes it more complicated. All right, very important, interesting issues raised. We'll look at all of them and see what we can do. That must be an important item on the in the report of this whole area, okay? All right, tea is not ready yet. Thank you, Ms. Fareen. So let's take the next input. It's Mr. H. Fortein. Western Cape Provincial Government. Where's Mr. Boutain? There you are, guys. Come over here. Yeah, yeah, right. Come this in here. Oh, you're not Mr. Boutain. You're Mr. Fountain. Boutain, here he comes. He's up. Come here. Oh, no, he's not.
I think in terms of this OSD element, what we should add to it is also the skills audit and the fact that we are currently not, the universities are not producing enough to fill the need in the industry of assessment specifically. So it's a combination of OSD and skills.
But just put all that in the report. Okay?
We'll do that.
I want us to look at that. If we have to meet with the universities to see how we can get it done, those must all be part of the proposals, okay? Okay, Mr. Fontaine. Very nice. Western Cape is one of the few governments that come here. You've been here for other hearings as well, so it's much appreciated, actually. It's very important for us to see not only how national government operates, but how provincial governments and what problems they have. So I really appreciate the effort. And over to you, 10 minutes, please.
Thank you.
Ms. Maribella, why aren't we getting the slide presentations? I'm sitting here with big, thick submissions and I'm not getting the slide presentations that are behind me, so I can't look at my computer. Okay. Is it even good? Is that why they're not complaining? Only me complaining. Okay. All right, so I won't complain again. Mr. Fontaine, over to you, 10 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While the slide is presentation is being loaded, Okay. All the members do have a printout, so I will continue anyway. Our cultural, our constitutional imperative cannot be ignored. Other speakers have mentioned it. The fact of the matter is that we have to have our environment protected not only for now, but also for present, also for future generations. And certainly, water is one of those issues. And the more energy we want, for instance, coal power stations, the more pressure we put on our water resources, which means that regimes like the EIA regime has to be effective enough to be able to deal with things like that. Our greatest need, if we can go to the slide there, the greatest need we have at the moment, of course, is for informed decision-making, where we have great socio-economic needs, limited resources, and a degraded ecology. And the environmental impact assessment is the most commonly used tool of environmental management to fulfill this imperative. The problem, of course, is that the perceptions we have of EIA at the moment are very negative. And the pictures that we have there show the people who think that EIA is there just to stop things, it's there to generate voluminous reports. The top left-hand one there is not the one on how to live with your spouse. It's the EIA that have generated reports like that. And of course, business complain that they held hostage to a process that takes too long and they're taken out of a financial cycle that can lead them into bankruptcy. So our challenge, of course, is to go from red tape to red carpet. But our goal should be to go from red tape to green carpet, and that's certainly one of the goals we have in the Western Cape government. And to accomplish this, we've established a special directorate called the Directorate for Development Facilitation Unit. Directorate for Development Facilitation. And its goal is to unlock many obstacles created by bad coordination, but also to look at proactive ways of supporting particularly municipalities and public sector agencies to be able to get the most out of the EIA process. The problem, of course, is that we do have capacity constraints, and it was highlighted by the previous speaker. There was a presidential project that looked at legislation that is impeding service delivery, and it highlights the fact that human agency was actually the problem and not so much legislation. Now, the approach that we have in the Western Cape towards EIA and environmental management in general is to look at proactive support to project proponents, primarily in public sector, and our Directorate of Development Facilitation Unit. I keep saying unit because it used to be a unit, but it's certainly development facilitation, is to be able to deliver the proactive support. This directorate was specially established for that. We also believe in giving advice on effective planning, both at the strategic and also at the project level. And then also we certainly make an effort to use the NEMA and EIA regulations very proactively and also smartly. So what guides our support? And I need to say that our department combines the planners and our environmental people. So in my directorate, I have land use management staff and also environmental staff. So it does help with integrating planning and land use considerations and also environmental considerations for particular projects. And certainly the legislation for both planners and environmental practitioners and administrative staff is having to place people that are in need at the forefront of our concern and also to protect the environment. Certainly in the Western Cape, our biggest focus is to support the frontline agency for development, and that is our local governments. We are very focused on progressively building our local government into an agency for frontline development so that our people out there can have effective services delivered to them. What is problematic, of course, is the lack of strategic plan at local government level in particular. For instance, you don't usually have integrated plan where your social development framework, your housing plan, and also infrastructure planning often do not speak to each other. You have projects that don't flow from relevant sector plans, and also this then leads questions being asked at the project stage that should have been addressed at a more strategic level. The other consideration, of course, is the fact that these plans all flow from an integrated development program which was formulated by a council that was democratically elected. So we need to be able to use instruments that have been determined or it's an outcome of a democratic process, which an EI process is normally not. It's normally confined to a group of stakeholders and not full communities out there. We also have a problem with project planning. For instance, ad hoc projects that are really not linked to any strategic plan. We have processes that could be run together, like a water use license process running with an EIA, that are sometimes done sequentially when they could have been done together, and various other aspects of bad project management. We have been asked as a department to explain why there have been certain delays in projects at both provincial and municipal level, and most often we've been able to pinpoint that it's just not good project planning at the local level by the implementing agency. We try to limit municipalities confronting issues downstream in the project cycle. Usually, you know, it's the wrong place to wake up and find out that you should have done this or that. That the, where you wanted to put your housing project is actually a biodiversity sensitive area. That should be dealt with further upstream in the project cycle. And so our next slide shows that the best time actually to be able to be talking to each other is at the IDP level, where you develop the management strategy, your biodiversity mapping, your spatial development plan, infrastructure plan, all of these. People must talk about these before they design individual specific housing projects, as an example. All these issues can then be ironed out before you get into the EIA. Another thing we also have considered, particularly in the Western Cape, is contingency planning, planning for informality and also disasters. And this requires negotiation, consultation and coordination between our various authorities and agencies. Just as an example, in the Monwabisi area, this is the first line here is 1996, where you can see individual, the red circle individual informal housing. The next slide shows how it's grown, and then the third slide shows in 2007 how it's grown. So one sees trends and one needs to plan these, and so the environmental considerations need to be discussed as part of the planning for dealing with informality like that. And of course in the Western Cape, in winter we have floods and in summer we have fires. And so we need to be able to take care of people when these things happen. Just as an example, in Khayelitsha over the new year, next slide, we had a fire, and this is what it looked like before, and after the fire, this is what it looked like. 4,000 people displaced, 854 shacks destroyed. So of course you need a temporary relocation area. Is that time to look at an EIA for a TRA where people need to be rehoused? What should have happened and what did happen was that the City Council had actually applied for EIAs before this for TRAs. In other words, so that they could be able to help people when we have these disasters. If we can just go back to the previous slide. What we also did was we had an integrated process. An integrated process that looked at the less formal township establishment legislation, and we integrated that with EIA. And that process meant that we could do the EIA and the land use planning in 30 days. And so we could have a decision at the end of 30 days because we integrated the process, because the legislation allows us to be able to integrate this process. Also, we need to apply EIA smartly, finding better alternatives, for example, next slide, using spatial instruments, and this was mentioned by previous speakers, instruments like the EMF, of which we have three in the Western Cape. Development of standards, where if you develop according to a specific standard, you don't need to do an EIA, and the national the government and provincial governments are looking at this project of standards. Also, the EIA regulations allow for exclusion zones where you don't need to do EIAs, And we need to be able to define and adopt these exclusion zones and be able to be proactive in being able to deliver to people up there without having to go through a process. There's also something called maintenance plans. In the Western Cape during winter, we have floods which destroy bridges and parts of farmland. And if maintenance activities can be defined before the time to cater for these things which happen regularly, we don't need to EIAs to be able to fix these things because there is a maintenance plan in place. I did mention the integrated processes, the power to these, where we don't need to do EIAs, but we can do it in terms of these other processes. Next slide. This is just an example of an integrated process. The next slide. So to improve municipal EIAs, we must make sure that as much as possible, all the various plans are integrated and that projects flow from the bigger plan. We need to explore options to apply more strategically for project approvals. For instance, look 10 years in advance and apply for environmental authorization for various phases instead of applying every time you get to another phase. Do more combined applications, agree on urban areas and setback plans, and then also have agreement between authorities on following an integrated process. Where appropriate to do so, use existing provisions that make life easier, improve EIA project management at municipal level, and our development facilitation unit helps our local municipalities with things like this, more proactive screening of projects, communication before time so we can identify stumbling blocks and issues that might arise during the EI process, improve communication between province and municipalities, and then also, of course, ongoing capacity building and support. Thank you, Chair. Our focus, really, in the Western Cape is support to our local municipalities and also to emphasize the integration of planning at a strategic and project level and environmental organizations. Thank you.
That's a very, very useful input, and obviously the emphasis on the municipal EIAs, I think, is absolutely vital, because all of us know that from the most problems government on, that's where we're the weakest. So I think your emphasis is really right, and the way that you present is very, very useful. Thank you very much. I was just thinking, do we have either at national or your province or other provinces a very simplified manual for these municipalities so that it makes it easier for them to be able to do these things and what we expect from them and the steps and the practical issues that we expect? Or do we just leave them to interpret the legislative framework or whatever there is to, in whatever best way they can? Do we have anything at national or provincial?
We have a series of local government support instruments that is developed through our local government support function, which is housed in my office, and one of it is around the EIA process as well as the proactive instrument, and that is rolled out through the district and metro municipalities.
What is the instrument?
It is the planning assistance tool, and it addresses EIA, but it also addresses the biodiversity, all the different regulatory requirements associated with the environmental portfolio is included.
You give that to municipalities, and if they follow that, they'll be able to do an EIA.
It's guiding them through the process in terms of advocacy, etc. In addition to that, there's the pro bono work that Alf has touched on, where we also provide further assistance to that. And then, of course, you're familiar with the EIS that SANBI has already rolled out, which will be supplemented by the portal that Alf has spoken about. But there is mixed take-up by the municipalities of that, and you will find that there is limited, if any, capacity at all, that you would find the environmental function in municipalities hidden with the parks or with the waste management function, that there isn't, that it is not necessarily always integrated into the planning aspects, which is different in the Western Cape because they are configured at provincial level to be environmental and development planning in one department.
What is it called, that thing?
It is the, I'll give you the correct title, it's the planning support tool for local government.
Planning support tool for local government. And then you said the pro bono, and then what was the third?
The third element is the GIS.
GIS.
In, yeah.
Mr. Fontaine, you want to add from the...
Yes, Chair, we do have guideline documents, and also an EIA...
The one that's attached here.
Yes. We also have an EIA primer, which we colloquially call the EIA for dummy. I didn't bring a copy with me, but that was also something which tries to make also the EIA process very clear. But I think I want to make, more importantly, we work with our colleagues at the provincial department of local government, and we do regular workshops with municipal managers, also with councillors, on environmental management, on planning, and also EIA. So we've had, I think, 24 workshops in the last 2 years where we talk about these things, also through our development facilitation directorate. We have regular communication with local authorities, and also with the housing colleagues. We also work very closely with them and with the local municipalities. So for us, it's very important, the ongoing communication and support. We believe that's more important than only giving them guidelines and manuals.
Mr. Wills, this must be an important aspect of the report. This whole issue of integrated planning, at least at two levels, that you integrate your environmental planning during the project phase in the beginning, so that it's part of whatever then happens, and not the other way around. I mean, you kind of have a problem with Mr. Fontaine and others have explained. So this must be an important part, and then on two levels I see it for now, maybe more. But the one of municipal support, and how we make sure that municipalities make sure that it's part of all their processes. And then, of course, the new infrastructure, the PIC, how do we make sure that the environmental planning is part of the project phase and not the other way around? Because we're going to really have enough problems there for not then downstream to start picking up all the environmental problems. And how do we, in all 18 or 19, those SIPs, from the beginning make sure the environmental considerations are part of the process? So there may be more places, but those two spring immediately in mind to me could make an impact, which is your infrastructure, big infrastructure, that's done at a PIC level, and then the municipal support that the West Cape has emphasized. And then how do we, I mean, if we have to put in, create tools in regulations or in legislation to make sure that that becomes part of the process, and if it doesn't, then the process is defective. If we have to go that far, I'm happy to go that far to do those kind of things. Okay, so those must be a major part of, definitely emphasized in the report, please, Mr. Wolf. Questions, comments to the West Cape? They seem to be very organized, very... Mr. Rogers?
So I don't think my comments directed at the Western Cape, but perhaps a general comment. If we go back to the department's presentation earlier and we go to page 9, where they've got a breakdown of the provinces and the department's EIAs received and reviewed. In light of what the Western Province said, that a lot of the delays are caused by poor project planning from the implementing agents, it would be interesting to know how Gauteng does so well. If I understand the figures correctly, less than 1%, they're not even at 1%, of their applications have been processed. This is perhaps the Western Cape, which is not the worst, it's one of the better ones, 11%. And then the department itself sits at 25% applications pending. Perhaps it comes back to the statements made earlier about appropriately placed staff, the qualified staff, but it's quite interesting to look at those figures. Thanks, Chair.
Any other comments, questions? All right, Mr. Fontaine, or even National, if you want to respond.
Chair, I think in terms of the response on the statistics, it is important to look at the pending applications, the breakdown after in those columns in terms of those that are within time frames and those that are outside of time frames. And that applies in both in terms of which is with the authority and then which is
outside of authority. We do think that it is really still largely dependent on the handheld system, as was explained by Alf, that there are probably incorrect figures presented by some of the provinces to make themselves look better, that the system that is in the slide below that will sort out, because you cannot on a knee system report better performance than what you had. Importantly though is that if you look back at what Ms. Fulis said, in 2009 we were at 75% within time frames. We are now above 90% within time frames in terms of the authorities processing things. There are issues around the staff capacity, etc., but there are also issues in terms of systems. In the Gauteng province, for example, if the information is not received within 6 months, they close the project. They made a one-off announcement, which has been challenged as not a legal correct process. But they close and they can then say, well, it has been processed because the information was not received and the project is closed. So I think there's those type of inconsistencies that you need to build into this figures as well. And there is certainly a lot of issues in terms of not receiving the adequate information to make the decision. But the point that I want to make here is it then falls back to the applicant and then your time frame stops. So if you say it took us longer because we didn't have the adequate information, the moment you send me back for more information, your time stops. So you only make the decision in the time frames once you've received the information that you need to make that decision.
Mr. Chair, I have a colleague whose main job is to track municipal and public sector applications. And she has to report to our MEC on this. So if there's no movement over a period of time, she contacts the case officer and says what's going on. And we then proactively try and get whatever information we must get. But some DIA, some projects just die natural death as proponents find out that the issues are a bit too great and they just don't respond. And then you wait 6 months and it finally closes. That's the usefulness of the EIA
program. Right in the middle of a wetland.
That's the usefulness of the EIA process, by the way, is that, but it's also because people haven't done their homework, is that issues come up you hadn't thought of before, and then they turn up to be fatal flaws, but of course that should have been determined before.
I really want us to look at mechanisms, legislative mechanisms, whether it's in the law, the regulations, protocols, guidelines, it doesn't matter. But I really want us to look at mechanisms, how to particularly force local governments to make sure that the environmental aspects of a project comes in the beginning and as part of the process, and that process grinds to a halt legally if it doesn't happen. I want us to look at... Don't worry now.
I think it's important to just link it to spatial planning and land use management law, which does exactly that. So I think when we have the discussions around the spatial planning and land use management law, it will be important to see where there are then still gaps. Should that...
That's the one that I'm still waiting from you and Water for comments on it.
Chair, you're not waiting for our comments that you had in February.
I'm not talking before the bill was passed, after the bill was finally passed.
I've
got a message that I sent to both of you guys. I wanted the final summary of it. So it's outstanding. Thank you. Please make sure I get my summary. Both, and you can also please tell Balser, Mr. Balser. I'm waiting for Water as well. Okay? Because if that legislation, again, this is again fragmentation, that legislation, we need to find ways then to pull all that together and make sure it takes place. Because now remember, that's a different department, different reactions to local government. We need to find, I'll expect that being looked into the report as well then, how we deal with the spatial planning thing. I wasn't aware of that, that it's in there. Okay? All right, is that it? Thank you very much, Mr. Mutain. Very useful again, as always. We always have you guys help us. Usually the Eastern Cape as well, but I see they're not here this time. Okay, thank you.
three steps.
All right, then see, and for those that need to go to dark, busy places, this is your occasion to do it. Get done with it, and then please come back.
Thank you.
There is a mission somewhere.
Number four is the answer to the actual authorization process.
It's difficult for the public to appeal against the decision if it has been issued by the MEC. The public cannot afford expensive legal review process. That is a threat to cost to civil society.
I'm not aware of this. What cost do you incur if you appeal?
If there is an unsatisfactory decision that has been issued by the minister, so even if the public is willing to appeal against that decision, they cannot afford the expensive legal
review. Yeah, but for that, what cost are they incurring? What is expensive? What is it that you have to pay for?
So if there is this authorization process that has been implemented by the NEC, so even if the public is willing to appeal against that decision, they cannot afford the lawyer's fee.
Now, I hear you saying that, but I'm asking, what is it that you have to pay, which is that you can't afford?
There's
an appeal now. So you're appealing against, to me.
The level of bias.
What costs are you going to incur?
To hire expensive lawyers to appeal against that decision.
So it's the hiring of lawyers. So if you don't hire lawyers or you argue yourself, then that cost is not incurred. I'm just trying to understand. I'm not questioning whether you're right or wrong. I'm trying to understand what you're saying. So it's the appointment of lawyers which is the cost. Are there any other costs that you have to pay for an appeal?
So, no, if you are about to hire your personal lawyers, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Continue with weakness number 5, there's a lack of ensure independence of the environmental assessment practitioners. EAPs are appointed to fulfill applicants' interests because there are financial interests that are involved. So they are not partial, they are always biased to favor the applicant's side since there are financial interests involved. That's what it is. And the sixth one is the assessment of the need and desirability of a project. Firstly, we need to ask whether is this project really needed, right time and right location. Because we believe that some of the projects are just there to serve political interest, and if we look at the jobs that are going to be created, we have realized that most of the jobs are created during the construction phase, otherwise in the long run, they won't be there during the operational phase. And there is no sustainability of jobs, as it is said by NEMA that Section 2, that development should be economically, socially, and environmentally sustainable. Weakness number 7 is the utilization of other instruments in relation with, or instead of EID. We believe that there are very important instruments that have been neglected during the environmental impact assessment, like strategic environmental assessment, special development framework, environmental management framework, and integrated development plan. In order to establish a broad context of an EIA, you have to consider these tools. Number 8 is the public participation, the transparency. We believe that the decision, as I've said, is being manipulated to favor the development side. And one other thing is that the public doesn't have an input on the appointment of environmental assessment practitioners, and there are no incentives that are being put to motivate the public to take part in decision-making processes. And number 9 is the lack of coordinated conservation. NEMA principles, NEMA section 2, that is under principles, it is clearly stated that during the development there should be consideration of biodiversity to avoid ecosystem disturbance and loss of biodiversity. But if it cannot be avoided at all, at least it should be minimized, because the present biodiversity is very important for climate change as a climate change mitigation method. And the developments are very detrimental to the biodiversity. As you can see over there, that they've already felled up a tree and lots of animals have died, and now they begin to say, now we'll do our environmental study after the tradition has happened already. And we believe that EIA is failing as a tool. And number 10 is the abuse of Section 24. We believe that the three measures are very strict. That 1 million rand fine is not enough, at least it should be increased. And number 2, they should demolish whatever has been constructed before the authorization process, and they should be given an order to rehabilitate. And that 24G should be transparent to the public also, they should know about it and have an input on it. And my
seen the new section 24.3 that we amended?
No, yes.
Have a look at it. It's in the NCOP at the moment. All the things you've raised are now included in that law.
Thank you, Chair. We believe that the above mentioned weaknesses undermine the ability of an EI system to fulfill its role, but either saying you've amended that, that's really good news, and I'm looking forward to raise the amendment. And we believe that it is important for future revisions that EI regulation consider past experience and associated concerns, and the EI system should help ensure ecological sustainable development and use of natural resources in a manner that promotes economic and social development for present and future generations, as stated in the Section 24 of the South African Constitution. Thank you for putting us this time to comment.
Yeah, I like your input, very concise to the point, and it's very good, okay?
Thank you.
We'll read it with the submission. That's a very good input. Of course, the amendment you must go and look at, because what it does, like Section 24G, we've amended substantially. It's now a completely different clause. Previously, it was a walla walla walla. It was a typical bunny-hugging little clause that had no teeth, nothing at all. It's just all fluffy and woolly. I never knew how the department drafted. Now we've given all the things you said. The possibility of stopping the program, the possibility of breaking down the project, all those are now possibilities that the authorities can have. And then, of course, in line with some of your other questions, we've also, to avoid time delays and so on, we've created special measures now, whereby that process can be then referred by applicant to the minister, national minister and so on, to speed up those processes. So look at a minute, those amendments, see if they help, and if you have further comments, let us know, okay? Any comments, any questions from this side? Members, it seems to be a very clear input. Mrs. Kusan, welcome. Good evening.
Good evening, Sir Kusan. Thank you for welcoming me. Sir Kusan, I just want to check on slide number 6, the political interest that you are referring to. Because when you talk about the bill, the bill seeks to address issues very partially, not very partially. It don't take any side. I just want to check what political interest there are to, in fact, that you are referring to in this slide. And secondly, the on slide number 8, the transparency and clearance. Because as far as I understand, when you involve people, start there to be transparent. And you must unfold everything so that they can understand of what transpires within that law. Can I just declare it on that? Thanks.
Okay, that's the transparency issue. You see, when you talk about public participation, more especially in rural areas, there are many challenges that are related to public participation. You talk of law, literacy levels, some are people, they take advantage of that. So, because people, they know about EIA, they know what is expected from them. So, it is easy to manage.
That's not transparency. That is mechanism not available to help let the poor participate.
There are other issues that are revealed during the process.
Well, tell us what they are. What other transparency? Because that's a public participation issue. We have it everywhere. The poor clearly may not be educated. They may not be able to read. They may not be able to understand the documents. Then they haven't got money for transport to go there, they can't drive. So all those we understand, and that is a weakness, of course, always. In our country, it's even a worse weakness. But what transparency issues you say there as well?
We believe that there are other issues that are not revealed during that participation process. There are things that can happen.
Like what? What's not revealed? Tell me, are we looking at this? How to improve the system? If you don't tell me, I don't know.
Questions
the EAP and also like the skeleton that they are using to conduct those EAP. Are they explaining what screening is scoping is to the public so that they will also have an input on those particular stages?
So
this, again, a public participation issue. Okay. No, that's, we'll have that in the report and see how we can deal with it. The other transparency, and the issue about it, you saying there is political influence and interest in the process, then of course it's your responsibility. Especially you guys who are an NGO and others who are a bit better informed than the ordinary public, to expose it. Get the media, go to if it's criminal, go and lay charges. If it's go
go to the media, I've got no problem with there's someone crooking and being political, using political influence to gain favorable decisions in government processes. I don't care who they are. I've got no touch with people like that. They must be exposed. And it's important that you collect the evidence and then expose them properly. As I say, if it's criminally, otherwise go to the media. Let's expose these things. We can't live in a country and complain about wrongfulness and so on and expect someone else to do something about it. And I'm not talking about you guys now. I'm now talking generally.
Yes.
And you will have the full support of this committee if you go around it the right way and expose any kind of political influences or interests in these processes. You'll have our support. We don't want our laws to be undermined. So please, this goes for people in general. Expose these buggers that take shortcuts. I know my DDU now arrived will very much support what I've just said. I don't even have to look in that direction. Okay. Thank you very much. As I said, it's a very useful input, very concise to the point. And we'll, of course, consider it in the drafting of the report. Thank you. Now, Mr. Dowling, nothing can be more important than Parliament. Not even a meeting with KZN. I know Mr. Rogers thinks it's a very important meeting today, but now we can get back to Earth like apparently they are here, living in action, now they're here. Sir, come forward. Come here. Come here, please. No problem. No damage. No fell, no damage. That's typical, you know, undermining the NGOs. Big government box. If you know who does, you just let me know. We'll expose them. All right, so first life, is it Mr. Lekhani?
Right,
Mr. Lekhani is here. Welcome, sir. You haven't been here this morning. What we do is we give you 10 minutes to give your input, and then if there are questions or comments, we'll take it from there. So welcome, sir. Thank you for the effort.
Thank you very much, Chair, honourable members, and colleagues that are in the House today. We chose not to do a PowerPoint presentation because we felt it made more sense to speak from the heart. You know, you can read as many documents as you wish and see lovely pictures, but rather just to hear what we have said. I think some people in the House might remember the consultative conference on national environmental policy in the 1990s, which gave birth to the National Environmental Management Act. And I think some of us in the room have been on that journey ever since. The intent of what transpired at CONEP was to ensure the greatest possible benefit to the largest number while harming none. But somehow it seems to have turned into economic development at all costs. But we seem not to ask the questions of what kind of economics are we applying? What kind of development are we applying? The truth is that when the EIA process unfolds, we find as a rule, I'm sure you've heard the story of lack of independence of consultants and such like, but there seems to be a paucity, a shortness of information given to us up front. So clearly we have more and more questions as the process unfolds, leading to, quite frankly, unnecessary delays. You know, a two-page background information document on a multi-billion rand project is clearly inadequate. I don't even want to go down the road of issues of language, of access, of translation and such like, which I'm sure the House is well aware of. The notion that any and all money spent in our economy is a good one and therefore good for us all is clearly a flawed assumption by mainstream economists. And we're finding that when we speak to the issue of alternatives within an EIA, it has been watered down to such an extent where alternatives are simply alternative physical sites. Whereas the intent in the 90s was alternatives of generating the same output. So if it were energy or water or sewage or sanitation or housing, whatever it may be, different ways of achieving that same objective. But now it's simply our choice is which site would we prefer, which clearly was not the intent of the way we worded the policy in the first place. The issue that worries us a lot is the lack of socio-economic expertise, generally speaking. I'm sure there are exceptions, but generally speaking, within the consultants engaged with us on environmental impact assessments, we generally seem to find a lack of knowledge of our cultures. We find a lack of understanding of how they can show us how their proposed plan responds to our needs, if at all. So we find out on a regular basis that if we are told there'll be jobs for people. When you read the final report, you realize that there may be some unskilled labor for a few months jobs when the project happens because it's a highly technical process. And that leads to even more problems, more legal challenges, and again, unnecessary delays. So I think we need to have not only the independence of the consultants, but the scope. And the scoping process that it used to have meant that the consultants were required by law to take on board what suggestions and recommendations communities may make. That seems to be no longer the case. You know, a few processes, including, unfortunately, some of our government processes, excluded the majority of submissions by civil society. We are supposed to be a consultative democracy. And I think those of us walking this road find it difficult to come to terms with the fact that our leaders don't wish to listen to a lot of people who wish to speak. And I think we need to address that. And I think we can. I don't think it's a difficult thing to do. But I believe it is necessary. People speak with a voice that we fought for so long. Surely we should hear them. The truth is, EIAs are the right tool. Together with the strategic environmental assessment make complete sense. But projects in isolation, paid for by the proponent, consultants paid for by the proponent. Consultants won't get work if they suggest a no-go or a different alternative. It's clearly a fatal flaw. So I suggest to my leaders that we need to ensure that this process works for us, for ordinary people on the street, those of us who care about issues of economic and social injustice, of environmental injustice, because that is what our constitution demands of us. So our plea is really very simple. To please take on board passionate people's comments. People have taken many, many hours of their time as volunteers to make input into all kinds of EIAs and policies and regulations, but are being roundly ignored. And I think, knowing where Uttata Madiba is today, I can do no better than close by quoting him. He said at the first session on the World Commission on Oceans, "Our policy must rest on the solid moral foundation of dedication to the primacy of people and their long-term well-being. We have to be on guard against temptations of short-term benefits and pressures from powerful forces at the expense of the long-term interests of all. We cannot afford to bargain away the birthright of future generations." Diabong, I thank you.
Thank you very much. Spoken from the heart, then, I'm sure not something that we can easily disagree with, but most of what was said disagree with. The problem, of course, is to practicalize it. That's always the problem. I was just wanting to see, Mr. Wolf, this is about the independence. What is the legal framework now? Is it just saying that if you want an EIA in these listed activities, there has to be an EIA, and then you get your own person to do that, and you don't have an association yet of these people, so there's no regulation of it? And is there any alternative, for example, if the department were found that a project is particularly controversial, to get a separate EIA done by someone for the department, for example? Just tell what are all the options there, Mr. Wills. I mean, just fully understand
Sorry, Chair, I will just put my historical knowledge of this field. Currently, the revision is that once the Section 24H registration authority has been approved, then it will be mandated that you use that. In the interim, there is requirements
there is a structure that is going to be applied
for.
And they will regulate,
yes,
and they will set the standards and so on.
As part of the application to the Minister, they've already addressed the issue around the code of conduct, the qualifications, the experience, and the disciplinary process around that. That's all included in the application.
In the meantime,
the requirements of what independence means is detailed in the regulations, and it includes, for example, your financial interest, your expertise in the fields that is required. There's a list of requirements. We have the ability to, at any time and at the cost of the applicant, through the regulations, insist on a peer review, which we have invoked in some of the big EIAs. We have, based on public comments, we have insisted on peer review, and it is being practiced generally.
Is that the alternative?
That is a peer review. It also, Chair, it is a criminal offence to do certain things as an environmental assessment practitioner. For example, to not disclose information that would be to the detriment of the application itself. And we actually have a successful court case where an environmental assessment practitioner was charged by not disclosing the presence of a weapon, and the court found the EIP guilty of being outside of the legal prescripts in that. They haven't hanged them. Well, we have a guilty verdict, which is kind of, you know, in terms of...
I'm joking, but there's a criminal process as well if they don't do so. Okay.
Absolutely, Chair. And I think the issue is that we need to have more of these things challenged in order to bring it to the fore. You would have seen in the recommendations that came from the different things that are being played with in terms of having a very administrative burden approach where the applicant pays, but the authority appoints the assessor, which then again compromise the ability. So there's options that we are looking in there, but we think the registration body is ultimately the best way of
doing it. I think we must go stronger than that. You know, most registration bodies, you see I'm doing this, it's wobbly. I'll give you a number. It's very wobbly. Because in the end of the day, you'll find that the people on there are themselves part of those practitioners, and they are not going to set standards for themselves and impede their ability to get work. I'm a lawyer, whether you go to my legal profession and see what the advocates and the attorneys do, it's like that. It's very difficult to do things against your peers and set standards. So I think the body is important, but it has limitations. I think what we must do is go a step further. I think we should, as a government, as a right, have the opportunity that even if we ask every time for an EIA from whoever does it, but the government, for example, Mr. Lakhania was saying, you know, take Isimangaliso's dunes. Take Isimangaliso's dunes. The government of the province, I understood, was very happy to destroy those dunes and give them mining rights. It was only when someone got Madiba and said to him, but these Jews are going to go. They took the helicopter and flew over it with Chief Buteleri and with Mr. Clark. And they then said, out, no mining. Now the problem is, there is an opportunity where someone took a political intervention, which we do, so you don't want, but okay, in this case we wanted it, and then stopped it. But the problem is, you know, it can be in the province can have a lack of capacity, doesn't have the necessary skills, someone comes up with a mining plan. For example, when you told me this morning that these laws don't apply in the sea, I immediately had horrifying thoughts. Can you imagine when we start mining in the sea and there is absolutely no system to regulate it? And someone starts just destroying whole pieces of coral reefs and so on, the whole fishing industry goes, you know, that's what worries me. So I think there should be processes that government can, where there's a very controversial issue in any case, create their own EID, government pays for it, and then can do it in a way that if it's counter to what the applicant EID people do, then now at least you've got evidence to do this. doesn't seem to me that there is a process like that, a peer review of that person. It's not a, and not an alternative process that you can go through. So I really think there is scope here to try and level the playing field much more. So you keep the basic system that, you know, put the applicant and let the cost be there. But I do think there should be a stronger system to be able to get separate information that is more balanced and neutral, or at least perceived to be. Because there's a lot of misperception. I mean, you, it's like me, when I appoint my lawyer to give me an opinion, and I give him the terms of the opinion, I mean, he knows what answer I want. I don't have to tell him, give me the answer. He knows I'm asking, this is the question I'm asking, he knows what's the positive answer to it. Now, I'm sure you know, anything in life like that. So please, let's consider that at least. I think there's a lot of scope that I've learned this morning. Sir, you wanted to raise something?
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, around the independence and not compromising the department, you know, you certainly don't want the EIA to go via the department that's going to make the decision.
Mm.
We have raised this before and we're all there and we agree. But we think there are alternatives. It could happen via, for example, via Treasury, for example. You know, where Treasury is actually a client. Why not? There's no reason why not. Where Treasury has to be satisfied that the work was done independently, you know, with all the comments being taken on board, resolved, etc. That's one of the thoughts. I'm sure the House might have other ideas for how to ensure that independence is better. The other thought was that there is no way really at the moment of measuring how the interested and affected parties felt about the process and the content. There's no, we don't have a way of saying, well, 90% of the INAPs think the consultants failed. That should be part of an EIA where every INAP is given a form, you know, to tick various boxes if possible, whatever it might be, that information is collated and forms part of the EIA that goes to the department for a decision. That is reflecting the voice of our people. For example, there was an EIA done about 10 years ago in the Pelindawa area, and we know that more than 1,000 people wrote letters based on a campaign we were fighting at the time. The consultants collated these and called it one submission from South Africa. Yet it was 1,000 different pieces of paper with 1,000 different signatures without the Earthlife logo. We had no recourse, because their final report said there were 4 against and, you know, 9 in favor. But that actually was not the truth. But we had no mechanism with which to show that this was the case. So I think the people that are affected should be able to mark, I suppose, the efficacy of the process. That is democracy in action.
Now I think we can look at that. How properly and accurately public participation is reflected in the process. We can see how we can strengthen that. But of course, the problem at the end of the day is if the decision, if law gives the decision to X, then ultimately the decision is X. I mean, it's not a, you know, how many people voted against it. But I think what you are raising is an important point. I don't think we do this good enough in all legal processes. Is to what extent you properly reflect the level of at least challenges or disagreement with this particular process. And Alf, I would like to see that dealt with in the report, okay? What are the mechanisms we can do to that more accurately? Do we create a mechanism where people that do can actually send that complaint straight to the department and not let it be processed through the people that are ultimately making recommendations? Because you can see what, I mean, there's no way you will ever be able to please people, because people will never think that if you are the applicant's lawyer or EAP, that you could reflect theirs properly. So I think, let's look at this issue. I think it's something that I find more and more is being raised, where people feel that their views are not. But as I say, legally, at a certain point, the decision must be made by someone. And but at least we would want to know that people's views are put not in a watered-down form, but in a form that you know, can impact. So just make that as a point. We don't let, Professor, we don't let people other than the committee members participate while a submission is being made. So you can imagine why, if you disagree with the gentleman here and you start attacking him, then we've given you a platform to do so, and that would be very unfair. So questions are asked by the members and in the committee. But if you pass on your, whatever you wanted to say to Ms. McCorp there, I'm sure she's finds ways of letting you know at some stage what it is. Further questions and comments? I think Earth Life has raised an important issue here, or a few important issues, but particularly this issue of independence and consultation. Anyone? Questions? Comments? Anything further? Anything further from you, sir, you would want to add?
No, just to say thank you for making this opportunity available. It's always a privilege to speak to our leaders. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of NAS.
The issue you raised, I want to find ways of us trying to be more innovative how to deal with this. As I say, I always, the Mandela example of Isis Mangaliso to me is a very important one. And how many, can you imagine how many instances there are in this country where there wasn't a Mandela intervention? And actually we've destroyed part of our heritage. I'm sure there are such examples. So we must try and make, get this balance right. Thank you very much, Isla. Thanks. What's the time? Huh? Oh, we can easily take. Please, man, step forward. Let's finish as much as we can. It's now the Board of Environmental Assessment Association of South Africa. Otherwise known as the Crooks, but okay. Environmental Brooks. Only joking. There is a submission and there is a slide presentation, please. And we have the Clela. Over to you, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you.
We'll take it from there.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, mm-hmm. and senior members of the Department, Honourable Stakeholders, thank you. I will be making a presentation on IPASA's proposed contribution to the quality assurance in environmental practice in the country. The submission is, remember, in April we submitted to the Portfolio Committee. I will also be looking at the IPASA's objectives, the contribution to the efficacy, as well as last week at the recommendation. The purpose of the submission that we did in April, Honourable Chair, was to provide progress on the process of establishing regulation authorities for environmental assessment practitioners as NDC, Section 24, NIMA, as one of the solutions in strengthening the EIA regime in the country. The first outcome of the establishment of a was the establishment of a representative and recognized association that would constitute a regulation authority which agreed registration system. This outcome, Honourable Chair, was achieved last year before with the founding of the IPASA board. We have 13 board members. Some members are present here today. We have Kerry right here next to me. We've got Dr. Hill, and then we've got Paul Hart-Hassler at the back. The second outcome in terms of progress is the registration of a qualification for environmental assessment practice within the National Qualifications Framework in collaboration with ACWA, the South African Qualifications Authority. This qualification was completed in November 2008. The third outcome is the conclusion of the relevant enabling legal mechanism making it compulsory for it to be registered. This will be implemented when the minister appoint IPASA as the registration authority for it in terms of Section 24H of NIMA. The objective of this association, IS Board, was to promote continued professional development for each in the country to promote transformation of environmental assessment in terms of representativity, to promote awareness of the purpose and practice of the environmental assessment in the country. It has a contribution to the efficacy. Like, remember when you sent the call for responses to the efficacy of the SIRA regime, that call indicated the number of challenges and critiques facing the EIA process. Now, quality assurance in environmental assessment practice is an essential part of enabling an effective environmental assessment regime. Hence, the main claim of IPASA is to advance the quality of environmental assessment practice in the country by establishing, promoting, and maintaining registration of it in terms of NEMA Section 248. Hence, you can see in the law there we have those with advancing environmental assessment practice in the country. That is the main purpose of IPASA. Experience has shown that the competence of practitioners...
How are you planning to do that?
That I'm getting into.
Okay.
Experience has shown that competence of practitioners has a bearing on some of the challenges experienced in the EIA regime. The IPASA's role is to address competence so that it can produce quality work and abide by the code of ethical conduct and practice. The IPASA's constitution contains a code of conduct regulating the ethical and professional conduct of members of the association. What the panel will do then is this: we will contribute to the efficacy of the EIA regime in the country by providing relevant authorities, development proponents, and the public in general quality assurance regarding its appointed to conduct and regulate the environmental assessment, meet both sides, the consultants as well as government officials. By establishing the educational qualification, professional experience, competency, we look into continued professional development, and procedures for registration and sanctions. The procedures for registration are already detailed in the constitution of IPASA. We uphold...
So you assess and decide who is a competent...
Yes, we'll do that. The criteria are in the constitution, what must you... what are those criteria for registration as well as your qualifications. So we'll also uphold a fine code of ethical conduct and practice and acting in the best interest of the environment, sustainable development and the public good. Also by establishing disciplinary procedures and sanction mechanisms for those who do not comply. IPASA is now in the process of applying to SAQA, the South African Qualifications Authority, to be recognized as a professional body and registering a professional designation in terms of NQF, the National Qualifications Framework. The board will engage with the Council on Higher Education through its Higher Education Qualification Committee to facilitate the accreditation of learning programs against the EA qualification. As you remember, Honourable Chair, Dr. Hill spoke to this issue earlier on. The last slide, IPASA submitted the request for funding to the department. However, the department has limited resources. We are then respectfully requesting the portfolio committee to review the allocation of the year in order to enable the full implementation of the registration of IF. As the registration of IF.
Why mustn't the IF pay? Why doesn't the IF pay to run the organization?
Yes, Chair, I think it's a valid question. We have looked at this and we have made some projections in terms of which the registration fees and whatever would come in, and but at the moment as a startup that is insufficient currently, and we also sit currently with a situation that we are not yet recognized as the registration authority. So I would then also preempt other questions around this, the issues of funding. We are looking at different sources of funding as well at the moment. We have requested, put in submissions for a request. However, we still have this chicken egg situation currently, which is currently the main stumbling block at the moment, is that we first need to see the recognition, so say some of the funders, before they could step on board. But as for it's very clear at the moment that we would like to make we strike a balance when it comes to the funding.
or the fees paid by professionals. We would like to strike the balance between a sustainability of the organization or association going forward, but also as one of our objectives is currently to make sure that we transform the industry. We would also like to make it accessible to some members, so we wouldn't like to charge exorbitant fees. So that is currently where we have balanced ourselves.
Yeah, you're balancing yourself wrong, my friend. You're going to balance, you're going to fall off the beam. Associations like this, particularly ones that get a lot of money and are lucrative, they fund themselves predominantly. You can't expect public purse to fund them. To fund them to make money and get rich, you can't do that. Not every single association that exists would expect government to do that. So I'm not saying that the department shouldn't look at that. They should always look at whatever you and then come up, but I think maybe we're barking up the wrong cupid. Okay? Leave it there, it's fine. Nothing's going to be finalized today, but we know what. Okay, Nico?
Thank you. Just a last slide. Thank you.
You see, I did it before we approve this being a great opportunity for you. You know what we do in this country? We create these structures that are going to regulate themselves. Everyone on the structure has an interest in that regulation. So at the end of the day, the structure becomes very ineffective, other than to protect itself. It's natural, not? I mean, you're not going to do anything different than all other structures have done. I mean, you look at the lawyer structure. The attorney structure has got attorneys on. Okay? So the attorney has to do all this stuff, that's discipline. So you do it with your own peers, people you meet every day, you look them in the eye, you discipline them, you do these things. You set the standards. And so what you have then, you become a very structure that keeps things going, and unless someone does something outrageous, everything is taken okay. I think we must here look at this thing differently. And we must see how we can make sure that this thing functions well. Because this is just not just another money-making structure. This structure is part of helping us preserve Section 24. That's who these people have to be. And like any other structure, there are going to be crooks, thieves, and corrupt people, part of the structure, but also members of the structure. Everywhere like that in society, you get corrupt politicians, you get corrupt NGOs, you get corrupt. You're definitely going to get corrupt EAPs as well. Now, the problem is that ultimately they must be independent in terms of how they practically run the thing. But whether to make sure that they are actually independent can't be done by them. So government has to look at mechanisms. How we make sure that these things are going to take place. Okay, here's an opportunity for us to look at some. I want to make it clear, no one has walked out of here and me having said that I said we want government to control this structure. As far as the structure is concerned, it must be independent and it can independently apply itself. But its own independence in a figure does depend on it. Because I know, like every other structure, the limitations that are going to make this sure. So you need to look at mechanisms, make sure they're made. For example, one of them, I can think of one now that doesn't exist. You annually, through the department, table a report in Parliament. None of these structures do that. Now immediately if you do that, it means when every year I tell you, hey, bring this bunch and let me talk to them in Parliament. We can then ask them questions. So you see what I'm trying to say? To actually make sure that they're doing what they want and they're independent. I think we must think out of the box a bit, without undermining their, what I call, operational independence. They must be operationally independent. They mustn't be able to call, pick up a phone and say to the DG, I want to appoint this person, can I go in? No, they must do, you apply the criteria, they must be operationally independent. But in terms of efficacy and other things, those things come from outside of us. Okay? And I want you to think out of the box, DG, before we sign off on this. Because once you sign off on this, then they become self-interested. You'll never get it right again. They're gone. Okay? Questions? Comments? very important cog in the wheel there, this one. Make this thing work better. Mr. Rogers?
Thanks. I just want to agree with what you said about the independence. In fact, very often these associations and these boards actually compound the problems that we face. They slow everything down and they create further problems for us. I must say, self-funded people are hungry people and that make things work. Whereas the state handouts, we become lazy and fat bureaucrats. I'm not saying that's the way we're going, but I concur with you, Jeff.
There is a danger. I don't have a problem in, you see, if you want to make them effective, you must give them the capacity to be able, if they've got criteria that this is what a person must, the criteria the person that they have before they get appointed, then they must have the staff to be able to make those assessments. Now, you know, that staff doesn't come cheap. So if the department in the beginning helps through staff in terms of being able to fulfill those functions, I can understand that kind of thing. But the issue mustn't be we're going to let these people pay less because of transformation. That can't be the issue. I mean, that just cannot be the issue. So I think that there's a balance there. And I know DG knows what I'm saying, what balance we have to get. There may have to be for government to help in the beginning to create a capacity that is at the right level. Now suddenly you start making one or two people, you say we're not going to appoint you because you don't have the criteria. Those cases are taken to court because they're going to challenge it. If it's a lucrative profession, they're going to challenge it. So you say you're not appoint me for this reason. Now if you don't have people that are competent to properly do those processes, you're just creating problems yourself in any case as a department. So that's what I'm trying to think of. I don't like your arguments about transformation and therefore we can't create charge. No. It must be like any profession like this, is you charge a percentage of the fees that people ask. You ask, you get paid by BP for 20 million rand, then you pay 1% of 20 million rand, and that's the money you pay towards the association to keep it alive. That's how you keep these structures alive. And whereas the small person that doesn't get the BP EIP, he gets the Duduza Forest Association, which has got a lot of poor people in it, he gets their EIP he has to do, then clearly his fee is only going to be 500, and 1% of 500 is going to be F. So it's not a question of charging a flat fee necessarily, it's a question of trying to see how you sustain organize. I don't fully know how you do these things, but I'm just saying to you, you guys have changed your thinking a bit about the funding. But I know DG is going to help you in that regard. Okay, yes sir.
Yeah. I just wanted to put it on record, and I think we're in agreement there in as far as it cannot be a long-term, we never anticipated that it would be a long-term funding. What we were thinking about was the startup phase where we still find ourselves in a situation where we have not yet been recognized, so we can't charge those fees yet to anybody, because this is the board right now and some people who are founding members. So I think we are in agreement that
now we'll support a department trying to create capacity for you in a certain period of time. I mean that type of thing. But I said, you see, what I'm just trying to say to you is you're thinking of we want to transform and there we go, I don't want to charge too much because then we're not going to allow black people in. It's the wrong way of thinking. You rather change the fee structure of how you're going to get the fees, that the rich ones pay more, and they pay X amount of what they get. And if you, a poor person practitioner just starting out, if you pay 1% of your fee, then clearly it's going to be much less.
Yeah.
And you understand what I'm trying to say, so you're going to just think a bit differently about it, okay? Okay, but I think we as a committee are keen to see you guys getting off the ground, because part of all these EIA, if you're listening to all the problems we're discussing and all the things that Mr. Wills has raised and other people have raised in the inputs, a lot of it's got to do with practical things, not so much about the legal framework and so on. It's practically, how do you make sure that municipalities in their planning actually integrate environment from the beginning? It's a very practical but a vital issue. I mean, how do we do that with infrastructure development, big projects and so on, that we don't bulldoze the environment thing out of it because we want this infrastructure plan, therefore, how do you make sure it's part of it and that's part of the decision making? So I think there's a lot of practical things that are going to have to be looked at and so on. And this is part of it, how we regulate the industry. But all that still, of course, still in the end leaves me with the issue that I think you must, what I do think legally must be looked at is to create where there are weaknesses in this system of having practitioners who are registered and so on and appointed and have got codes of conduct and so on, where there are weaknesses in that, to make sure that we can override that. And the easy way to do that is, particularly with, say, controversial projects, that the department or the competent authority must have automatic right to have another EIA going parallel with one that the applicant has done. It has to be like that. It's the only way we're going to have the kind of quality assurance and the kind of Madiba intervention. So that someone at least can complain to you and say, this process here is going wrong. And if you then think it's valid, the DG must have the authority to be able to say, okay, we're going to have another EIA running here. It's very vital to have that happen. And by saying that, that doesn't in any way undermine this thing we're facing here. It's a parallel process to that for quality control, okay? Particularly on controversial issues. Mr. Wills?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make 2 points. The one point, I think, that we need to acknowledge that the government reviewers or the government officials responsible for reviewing these EIAs will also be required to be registered practitioners. So it's not only for the independent, for the consultants, as it were, it's also for our own officials.
So there you found the way how you can give some government money to them.
Exactly. And part of our agreement is, at least at a startup phase, would be for us to pay subscription fees as candidates at the candidate level for our own officials in terms of beginning to create at least a sustainable income stream. That's the one point I would like to make. The second point that I'd like to make is that in the appeal process, the MEC or the minister has the right at this point in time to run this parallel assessment process. But it's at a much more flexible level in terms of the rights of not having been forced in that process to follow exactly the procedures as laid out. So
that's good to hear that, but that's too late. I think we must just change the law to make sure that you also have that power, really.
I hear what you're saying.
Other thing, Mr. Wolf, is who's going to be on this board? Who's on the board? Who are the kind people on there? Are they all people that have a self-interest in the thing? And it's always a democratic process. The democratic process is used to get the results you want in these organizations, and that is that everyone with a self-interest is on it. Now, I wanted to know to what extent there's any independence on this board. Are there any old people on it? One. Did you must look at this thing carefully.
Who's representing?
You see, if you look at any boards, if you look at the sheriff's board, for example, it's dominated by sheriffs. If you look at the attorney's profession, it's attorney. If you look at the advocate. Now, the problem is all those people are self-interest. So any decision they make which is negative towards the profession is negative towards them. So you don't make the decision. So you have to find a way of creating an efficient board, an effective board, but one that really has some independence and will be able where the issues of just being lucrative for the practitioners are not the sole criteria that drives the organization. So it's very important that you get that balance right. If you get one that's completely dominated by EAP practitioners, even the good professor, they will tell you. That at the end of the day is not how it's going to create the structure that is going to. Because I really, we must look at this thing differently. This thing is about having people with enough integrity to act against their sole self-interest if it's going to protect the environment.
and live to our constitutional imperative. That's what we're creating here. We're not creating a board of lawyers or a board of doctors or a board of whatever. You're creating a structure that is the quality control for making sure that our decisions around environment have integrity in it. Now, and you're asking this from people that are going to get paid to do the job. It's a very difficult balance to get. So this is just, DG, this is not just another board. This is like really something else. And that's why I think we should think out of the box in terms of how we want to make sure this thing has the right balances and work correctly, okay? The more I actually talk about it, the more worried I get. Because I can start realizing that we create a monster here for ourselves, which is then very difficult because later if you then want to try and do something about it, government's intervening, government's intervening, that's what's going to happen. But meantime, we are creating a structure where you actually are watchdogs for the environment. But yes, they're making money. Because they're making a job. It's a job for them. They have to do EIAs. Look at that NGO community there. Mr. Lukunia would sit here. It's very difficult to persuade him that any person that is appointed by an applicant is neutral. You'll never be able to persuade him. Now we're entrenching that and we've given them the bigger task to be the protectors and help us protect Section 24 and achieve the objectives of 24. That's what this structure will do. So this structure is not just another professional body. It is a professional body with a difference. In the struggle we would say that it's socialism of a special kind. This is a body of a special kind. Okay? A body of a special kind. It's not just another professional body. You guys really make sure we get this balance right. And I actually think, DG, before you guys approve it, maybe you must come and give us a briefing. And it won't be wrong if you actually give us documents and you'll have looks at some of these documents of what they're saying and how the board wants to be formed and how the structure is going to work. So we give it to members so they can have a look at it. So that we also feel comfortable about what we're doing. Because as I say, the more I talk, actually, the more I get worried because I can see that this is a something very different animal that we have to create, okay? Alright, anyone want to add to that? Say anything further? Okay. Alright, I don't think the next three inputs, I see one person involved and all of them. This is how you make sure you get seen in Parliament. You make sure that three inputs come and given you on the all three delegations. Only joking. So they're not here, so we can't do it yet. Okay. We'll meet at 2 and finish the last three submissions, which are where were they? It's Legal Resources, the Durban Environmental Alliance, and Federation Sustainable Environment. Okay? Thank you, ma'am, and to your delegation. Okay? Thank you. DG, can we have all those documents and so on? And let's follow up on those. Okay.